Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from Behemoth.com.
So today's podcast is about Hermes Trismegistus. And he's a kind of a central figure for alchemists and alchemy in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance. Basically, he's it's kind of a nebulous, maybe mythical figure. But in short, it's a combination of the Greek god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth. They have some things in common. So the Greeks would associate Hermes with Thoth, and they're not exactly the same, but they're both the gods of writing and magic. Thoth, in particular, was the god of magic, writing, astrology, alchemy. They both were psychopomps, which means they carried souls to the afterlife, or would kind of escort them to the afterlife. Hermes is equivalent to the Roman god Mercury, and Mercury is also central to alchemy. The planet Mercury is very important in astrology. Mercury, in the sense of quicksilver, is important to alchemy, obviously. But let's dive right into some of the myths regarding.
And there are actually plenty of myths about Hermes Trismegistus. He was actually placed, according to mythology, in the early days of the oldest dynasties in Egypt, long before the days of Moses, if you can wrap your head around that. Some authorities regard him as a contemporary of Abraham, and some Jewish traditions go far as back as to claim that Abraham acquired a portion of his mystical knowledge from Hermes himself. One of these myths relates to him vanquishing Typhon, the dragon of ignorance, and mental, moral, and physical perversions. So he's a hero of intelligence and health.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that we have to look at when we think about placing him in these times are the fact that he was supposedly a contemporary of Moses,
yeah,
the grandson of Adam,
mm-hmm,
and the builder of the Egyptian pyramids.
So he's got a
very busy CV. I think he'd be hired anywhere, if you will. In the same way as Hermes Trismegistus, Imhotep and Amenhotep defined as gods of wisdom and medicine, basically their understanding of science in the Ptolemaic period. So a very influential period of Egyptian history,
mm-hmm,
and Trismegistus is wrapped up right in that mythology.
So the Ptolemaic period. So this is, some of our listeners might not know that. So Ptolemy was one of Alexander the Great's generals, right? So this is, it's, and then he started a dynasty of Egypt, which Alexander the Great conquered. So we're talking about Egypt, but this is where the combination of Greek and Egypt comes from, because they had Greek rulers, the last of which was Cleopatra. And so they would speak Greek, but at the same time, they tried to incorporate, you know, just like we talked about Hermes and Thoth, for instance, like they would try to overlay the Greek gods with the Egyptian gods when they could. So like when you mentioned Imhotep and Amenhotep being kind of deified, those were not gods per se, but they were like prophets. So they worshipped Hermes Trismegistus and these others as gods, but they acknowledged that they were prophets or some kind of important people. Some of the oldest writings we have that refer to Hermes Trismegistus have to do with they're Hellenistic writings, so Greek writings, and they include like Greco-Babylonian astrology, and at that time the newly developed practice of alchemy, which definitely has its roots in Egyptian times, but then the Greeks took it over. It has a lot to do with Gnosticism later on, like, you know, let's say first is the 3rd century AD. We'll get more into that in a second. But the The central thing of alchemy, this transmutation, which we talked about last episode. So the like in this case, it's the personal ascension from the constraints of the physical being to, let's say, the afterlife, right? So think pharaohs, the afterlife in general. So you die, you pass on, but your soul is transmutated, right? So many Christian writers, and this is what I think is really interesting, is that many Christian writers, including Lactantius, Augustine, Giordano Bruno, Marsilio Ficino, Pico della Mirandola, who we'll talk about later in a future episode, and some even say Zoroaster and Plato might have considered
For him to be actually a prophet.
Yeah, they also sometimes, what I mean is they sometimes wrote about Zoroaster and Plato in this way, that they would be a prophet kind of predicting the coming of Christ. And this gets really interesting. We'll talk about Kabbalah in a future episode, but there's also Christian Kabbalah where they say that through this numerology and looking at certain words, Kabbalah can prove that Christ was the Messiah, which is an interesting idea.
There's things that even happened in the 20th century where people would take this numerology of the Bible and add up things to say when the end days.
I saw a documentary on that.
Exactly. Yeah. This is something that's been age after age kind of rears its head again, that the Bible's a code book of sorts, other than wonderful stories and ideas about religion, that it has some mystical meanings to it. But yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we'll have an episode on that for sure. It's pretty interesting stuff. And so some of these alchemists really delved into that, and that's kind of the core of their philosophy. So we will talk about that. So Hermes Trismegistus. Trismegistus is often referred to as thrice great, or the great, the great, the great, or depending on which writings. And he's mentioned a lot going back into BC. So even if some of the writings that we today have comes from a later period, he was mentioned before. There's a couple of philosophies there, like why is it thrice great? One is that the wisdoms is alchemy, astrology, and theurgy, like the call it magic from God or knowledge of God, that he was a philosopher, greatest priest, and greatest king. So, you know, the great, the great, the great. Then when we talk about Hermetica, or we'll mention some things called Hermetica, but generally what that means is the works written by him. So he was mentioned pretty early on by, I might butcher this name, Lamblicus and Metheno, Egyptian priest who wrote kind of the Egyptian history of Greek. But, what is Hermetica?
Well, Hermetica, in short, is comprised of 42 books, and it's about the occult in general.
Yeah.
If you had to sum it all up, things like astrology, theological, philosophical, medical, law, alchemy, music, geography, you name it, specifically magic. All right, so we talk about the occult, that's what we're talking about. And most mysterious thing known to man?
Yeah.
Women.
Oh, yeah.
The great enigma, if you will. It doesn't surprise me that would be part of it. These writings were actually probably written around the time of the 1st to 3rd centuries Common Era, CE. So that's something to kind of give you an idea about the placement in history.
Yeah.
Pretty much at the time when Christianity was just getting going, Europe was in a time and place where the Roman Empire was starting to have its downfall, and a lot of changes were happening in the Mediterranean era as well as North Africa because of the Roman downfall. So a very influential era.
That's in a really important time period. So before, when we mentioned contemporary of Moses or grandson of Adam, the actual writings that we can kind of date is from the first to third centuries AD or CE. And just to kind of give talk about how they're written or what form they're written, is they're often in kind of dialogues like Plato, so kind of philosophical discussions, you know, between two people, normally between Hermes Trismegistus himself and somebody else.
Were they more very Socratic?
Something like that.
The answers are found
exactly.
within questions.
Yeah.
So what
exactly.
do you think that means? Which is a little frustrating for most people when yeah. you get taught in that direction, that Socratic behavior.
But that's a good way to kind of explore an issue.
Sure.
You know, have kind of two fictional people or two
very
historical
Greek.
People. Yeah.
Very Greek.
Yeah, kind
yeah.
of. So... And you just mentioned a lot of different topics, like, you know, so medicine, law, but then also alchemy and magic, right? So generally the Hermetica is broken up into two parts. It's often called the popular part or the philosophical part, which mostly deals with occult, like astrology, magic, alchemy, and then the learned or technical parts, which... often reflect beliefs in the older Roman Empire, which is interesting. So, like, you know, from the first century AD. So that could be medicine, law, that kind of thing, but clearly from that time period. So not necessarily what we would consider medicine or law. But what we're interested here for the sake of this podcast is the popular or philosophical part. So magic, alchemy, astrology, and that included potions. And this is what was really interested the medieval alchemists, and in a very practical sense. So they thought that he had the secret to gold. So, for example, there you've heard hermetically sealed. So that can refer, there's a couple of theories. Either that's saying, so this is secret knowledge, that the knowledge is so closed off that it's hermetically sealed. Or it can mean that, yeah, like the closed nature of writing. So it's secret, so it's hermetically sealed. Or it can mean something to magically protect an object. So it's hermetically sealed, as in it's magically protected.
So you're telling me that when something is sold to you as Tupperware, if you will, as hermetically sealed...
Magic.
...that it's supposed to, magic is supposed to keep your food safe.
My food stays fresh.
Your mac and cheese is what you're telling me will not go yeah. bad due to the occult magic of hermeticism.
That's right. Yeah.
Fantastic.
So unfortunately, there may have been older books. You know, I'm willing to bet there was, but most of those books were lost in the Library of Alexandria and other such.
Thanks, Caesar.
Especially well, yeah. There was, of course, when the Christians finally became the majority in the Roman Empire, they had a great part of burning some of these heretical hermetic books as well. So, but the most important book or hermetica, let's say, is the
Emerald Tablet.
Yeah.
All right. So the Emerald Tablet is one of the more profound legends in Hermetica. They say it's found in a cave clutched in Hermes' hands by Sarah, the wife of Abraham.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I don't think I missed that in Bible class, but still, I think that's part of the legend. It would reveal the secret of primordial substance and transmutations. So that would be maybe the, if you can't, I don't want to, you know, give you a cross section of this, but maybe the Rosetta Stone of the occult. Some people might look at the Emerald Tablet as such a thing. It first showed up in the 10th century. Some say as early as the 7th century, but circulating around the 13th and after, translated into Latin by the year 1140
yeah.
AD.
So alchemists knew of it for sure by then.
So the Emerald Tablet is really from the words Phoenician or Arabic into Persian, Turkish, Hebrew, Russian, and finally into English by none other than Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
So there's a pretty wide... You think that the Bible's been widely translated to many different languages. So was the Emerald Tablet. It was actually found by Alexander the Great in Hebron, again, steeped in mysticism and mythology. So here's this one of the youngest conquerors of the world, in Alexander the Great, conquering nation after nation.
Even that's probably... just a story.
I would have to say so.
Yeah.
I think we would have heard a lot more about that through Alexander's exploits. But still, nonetheless, wherever you see the Emerald Tablet, there's usually going to be some sort of connection to a well-known person to add some validity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another thing that I'm sure you've heard of before is the caduceus, which is the symbol of Hermeticism. And you've seen it. It's like two snakes spiraling upwards with kind of wings at the top. And it's often confused with the rod of Asclepius, which is the medical symbol.
See, that's where I thought you were going, because I have seen the medical symbol with the two circles.
Well, actually, so it gets confused so often that sometimes the hermetical one gets used as a medical symbol. There's like the one in the Army Corps, they just plain use the wrong one. So at this point, they're both, and it's, they're not wrong, because Hermes was also god of medicine, among a thousand other things. So... you know, in fact, Hermes, the Greek god, like that was a generic word for god in the ancient Greek days. So, I mean, sure, okay, why not? You know, use both. So what Hermeticism actually is, like what the philosophy is, and it wasn't so much an organized religion in the sense, but it very similar. I mean, so what it was is a kind of a fusion of Eastern religion, religious elements, let's say, and sometimes very similar sounding to like Neoplatonic beliefs, Stoicism, Gnostic beliefs. Like there's a huge overlap with Gnosticism. If you read about Gnosticism and you know what Hermeticism is, sometimes you think you're reading that. Kind of Neo-Pythagorean philosophies. There's even some aspects, like the way that you ascend to heaven is very reminiscent of like the Kabbalah's tree of life. So there's a lot of these esoteric beliefs that are kind of central. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about or do an episode on this, is that in future, I mean, it's almost impossible to come across an alchemist and say they don't have a hermetic core. So it's just good for our listeners to know, you know, what I mean when I say hermetic core in almost every single podcast. So, and we'll talk about Kabbalah, we'll talk about Neoplatonism, and all of those just have so much in common. Neoplatonism especially, so what that has in common with Hermeticism is that Hermeticism believed in a kind of a Neoplatonic importance of God, and they even call it the All or the One, which probably come directly from Neoplatonism. They also had the four elements, like air, earth, fire, and water, which Aristotle mentioned a lot. So, you know, has a lot in common with just other ancient Greek belief systems. And then, so at its core, at the Hermetic's core is the Prisa Theologica, so an original kind of untainted, like really like pure knowledge, let's say, and it was, you know, kind of esoteric in nature, and you know, supposedly compiled in ancient times in Egypt, and so just pure wisdom, you know, and just undiluted form.
Was it wisdom for anybody, Travis, or was it wisdom?
Well,
for
there was an esoteric sense, like. I don't want to say secret society, but like, because that idea, there's definitely Hermetic secret societies much, much later. But yeah, a sense that maybe not everybody could handle it, or that with wisdom comes power. So, you know, something to be guarded.
It sounds a little bit like Gnosticism. This information is only for a select few, because the rest of the poor slobs around the world can't handle it.
Yeah, maybe you can't handle it. Yeah.
Right. Interesting.
I'm not sure I can handle it. but yeah, so definitely Greek, or, you know, let's say even more so Ptolemaic Egyptian in origin, so this Greek-Egyptian influence. And then when that era fell, it was still cultivated by Arabs. Then not until like medieval times, there were some Arabs that kind of went against it, saying, well, this isn't like Muslim belief, this is something else. But it was still cultivated by Arabs, as was alchemy, and then through them reached the West in various waves, and even before the Renaissance, even before the collapse of Constantinople, and the reconquest of Spain and all that. So it did filter through. Actually, probably one of the very next episodes will be about Albertus Magnus, who's a Catholic saint, but also studied. If you say he studied Hermeticism, he would call you a liar. But he maybe didn't know it so much, but he did, and because he studied kind of Arabic academic stuff, and there was just some of this Hermeticism mixed in, whether he knew it or not, or liked it or not. But so to come back to what the philosophy is, so it's definitely, it has the idea of the development of the soul, which again is, you know, you can talk about transmutation, right? And then what's central, what is mentioned in the Emerald Tablet is as above, so below, which is central to astrology, as central to, all kinds of, like, Neoplatonic beliefs, again, Gnosticism. So the microcosm of man is reflected in the macrocosm of God.
Okay.
Right? So
okay.
As above, so below.
You got to
right?
say that one more time. There's a lot going on.
So, yeah. So, right. Well, okay. So to give you an example, that's how the stars or the heavenly bodies can affect us, right? As above, so below. So what's written up in the sky, this is not my personal beliefs, this is like astrology, right?
Okay. Okay.
So the macrocosm of God, the great cosmos, affects the microcosm of man, right? Some of these beliefs can get kind of funky.
Well, there's also some like, common line in this. I mean, there's also the,
well,
in Christianity, what is on earth is as well as in heaven.
Yeah,
that's constructs
right.
as well. So I mean,
yeah.
There are connections between what we consider heavenly bodies and what we consider
yeah.
here on earth.
Well, yeah. So I mean, yeah. Isaac Newton wrote about this, but he was really an occultist. But even Albertus Magnus. Because I was just doing some reading on him, and so he's definitely—I mean, he's a Dominican monk. I mean, a friar. He's definitely a Christian. You know, the old school Catholic. However, he had a belief. So astrology at this point was just common science. They didn't know any better, or I don't want to insult any people that buy into that philosophy, but. At that time, astrology just simply was fact. So even in the Catholic Church, what Albertus wrote, and this influenced all future astrology, was that, so God imposes his will on earth, right? However, there's these heavenly bodies in the way, like the planets, the stars, sun and moon, and these affect God's will. So God's will, by the time it gets to us, is kind of tainted. Right, so by reading,
or sometimes muted by the
yeah.
by things in the way, such as planetary bodies.
Exactly. So yeah, okay. You know, maybe the gravity affects it. I don't know. But in any case, by reading the stars, you can then be aware of that, and you can counteract that. So you say, oh, it's going to be a full moon. This temptation will be stronger, so I need to say that extra Hail Mary. You know, so even in Christian thought, they took that serious. And this was, you know, one person's writing, you know, in the 13th century. But still, so this is all central. And, this as above, so below, it's in the Emerald Tablet, like I said. But you'll find that in all of these beliefs. Very similar thoughts in Kabbalah as well. And then another thing is the dichotomy of good and evil. So just like Zoroastrianism, of course, Christianity. In fact, Hermeticism says they go beyond this and say there's like white and black magic, like good magic, which is theurgy, and dark like evil magic, which is I'm going to butcher this, but goetia, something like this.
Is that common for, like, as we talk about witchcraft, that there's white magic or there's white witchcraft and there's black witchcraft?
Well,
as far as spells
I would say even back in medieval days, if you talked about black magic, a lot of it came back to this.
Okay.
And that probably comes back to the 3rd century, like kind of Neoplatonism, because Aristotle, like the Catholic Church studied Aristotle. And inadvertently, I'll say that if you study Aristotle and you study some of the wider writings out there, you're inadvertently studying Neoplatonism. So even if you don't know that, you just think, oh, I'm studying Aristotle. Like, some of this was written 500 years after Aristotle was dead and written by Neoplatonists who were really closely related to Gnosticism or, you know, so it all ties in. Another belief, and this, I couldn't find a bunch of sources on this, but possibly even reincarnation. It was mentioned somewhere, and you know, again, some of these writings, it wasn't one author. Hermes Trismegistus, if he was a real person, by the time that we get the Hermetica, it was written by all kinds of different people. So the beliefs are not necessarily consistent, or, you know, it's, you get different theories out there, and this spanned centuries. So clearly different thoughts at different times. To kind of jump ahead a little bit.
You know, I don't think we really want to go too far ahead in the centuries, because things kind of get a little murky and get away from some of the point that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to really go into the 19th century orders that sprang up from all this, but we do need to sort of talk about that. That there are some interesting stories in their own right that involve Aleister Crowley and his right. Wars of Magic, but you know, we're not really after that in these particular podcasts for History of Alchemy. The orders that we alluded to include rituals and resemble Freemasonry, which may be another story we could talk about on some other shows about how that relates. There were sometimes founded in Rosicrucians and incorporated in other occult beliefs like Kabbalah, which we have already talked about, and I'm sure we'll probably dive in it at some point again. So this does have a spring effect where it kind of deviates from what we're talking about tonight and morphs into something else throughout the centuries.
Yeah.
But like you said, we were talking about this before the show, Travis, when you kind of look at something from the 17th, 18th, or 19th century when mm-hmm. it comes to Hermetica, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt because it's not really the same type.
It's a different beast.
It's a different beast.
Like Aleister Crowley, it's actually like the order that he belonged to for a short time before he had his wars on, you know, magic wars. But it was called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and they still exist. I mean, they're still around. But it was founded by Rosicrucians, so, you know, totally different kind of thing. And so there's definitely believers in Hermeticism today. And they're more kind of, you know, practitioners of magic and this kind of thing in a very different sense, I would say, than the alchemists that we're going to focus on in the medieval days. I mean, the bottom line is that there was a lot of Hermetic writings that popped up in the 18th century, and there's just too many of them for them all to be genuine. It, you know, that's the bottom line. So if you prescribe to one of those orders, you know, that's great. I know there's a lot of them out there. It's really interesting stuff, but our focus is really more the alchemists, Middle Ages, Renaissance, and, then the influence on early modern science. So 19th century, you know, that's you know, you could do a whole nother podcast show on that whole thing. So that kind of wraps it up for this week. I have one correction from last week, or rather kind of some details that I went through my notes and I found my original source. So we talked about those two Nobel Prize winners that to hide their their Nobel Prizes from the Nazis, they gave it to a chemist who threw them in this agua regia, this acidic thing that dissolved the gold. And So I found that original story because we were kind of vague on the details, right? And so when the war was over, the chemist was able to get the gold back out from the acid, and then they gave that back. So it was a lump of gold, like we thought.
Yeah, we kind of think it was a bad deal. They would be giving back a lump of gold.
However, yeah, so that part we got right. But then they went back to the Nobel Committee and they recast the prizes. So they did get get their Nobel Prizes back. And the source from that was Dan Lewis's daily newsletter that I subscribe to. Is called Now I Know, which is, yeah, there's some pretty interesting stuff in there. So every time they mention alchemy, you know, obviously I gotta take some notes there. The one for this week, I kind of scoured all my books at home. It's interesting. They all have something on Hermeticism. So there's Merriam-Webster's Encyclopedia of World Religions, Alchemy by Stanislav Klosowski de Rola, Rosemary Ellen Guiley's Encyclopedia of Witches and Witchcraft. I use some sources on Wikipedia, some other websites just to get a kind of an overview. Every book on alchemy is going to start with this. One of them, and I don't think I listed it, but one of them actually, because I didn't use the, but it actually had Isaac Newton's translation of Emerald Tablet. It had a different translation from Latin. So Yeah, it kind of, in fact, that book started and ended with the Emerald Tablet. So it's, if you study alchemy, or if you start looking into this, this is kind of the core, like the heart of it. So in Western alchemy, not Indian or Chinese alchemy, but if you don't understand this, it's harder to describe some of the later concepts that we'll talk about.
In other words, this was your vegetables that you had to eat tonight, folks.
That's right. This is the broccoli.
You couldn't go right to the dessert. You had to have the broccoli first. So now that's out of the way. And you're a little wiser
and
healthier.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think we'll expand on this when we kind of compare and contrast it to Kabbalah or Neoplatonism, or when we talk about astrology. I'll definitely do an episode on astrology, because those two go hand in hand. So you'll get some kind of, you'll get a broader picture as we move along. But so hopefully you kind of have a, I mean, this is nebulous. Who is Hermes Trismegistus? I don't think we still know, but at least you've heard some of the kind of myths out there. So thanks for listening. Check out historyofalchemy.com. It's kind of a Wikipedia format of all this alchemy stuff that we're doing. This episode and others will be on historyofalchemy.podhoster.com. And then email us with feedback, questions, corrections, suggestions, if you have ideas, to podcast@historyofalchemy.com. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you.
You know, we also have another show, a show that I run that's connected to my blog, bohemican.com. It's the Bohemican podcast. So we definitely want to have you over there. I'd like to invite you over to that program as well every 2 weeks. It's all about Czech history and interesting Bohemian tidbits and my life here in the Czech Republic. Also, you can take a look at us at bohemican.podhoster.com. When you come by the blog, you'll find a hodgepodge of what it's like to be here in the Czech Republic, and I think you'll find it very interesting and see what we're up to here in Prague. So we'll be back every 2 weeks. Thanks very much for listening.
Yep, thanks.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.